Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
At Deutschlandfunk Kultur, a very warm welcome to Daniel Allen. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Daniel Allen, if we look at our Western democracies in North America, in Europe, would you say that we live in just societies?
I think we live in societies where we know a lot about the definition of justice and we are failing to deliver on it. I think the range is great across our societies. For example, if you compare the US and Germany, Germany delivers with regard to health, with just structures, just infrastructure, just provision at a much superior level to what the United States is currently achieving. Mm-hmm. So I think different countries are facing challenges with regard to the realization of justice that have different shapes. And I think it's important to recognize, therefore, that the situation really is various from one country to the next.
Before we look more closely at what you propose, let's take a step back for a second, because we are facing multiple crises on a global level, but also in our Western democracies, like the climate crisis, the corona pandemic, an important economic crisis, right-wing populism and extremism. So shouldn't we be talking about sustainability, about redistribution, about political education, rather than about justice?
Justice is tightly connected to questions of sustainability and political education. From my own personal view, human beings flourish best in contexts where they contribute to political decision making. That needs to be done through structures of institutionalization and mediation through representation. So I'm talking about forms of participation that are different from sort of unmediated populist approaches to participation. Nonetheless, I do think human flourishing depends on human empowerment. So as we are trying to address problems like climate change, problems like racial justice in this country, the COVID pandemic, we need effective governance that is rooted in strong systems of constitutional democracy. So to have justice, to deliver that well-being that flows from empowerment, requires political education. You can't have effective structures of constitutional democracy without political education. You need a social sustainability, not just climate sustainability, in order to deliver that effective governance. So I do think at the end of the day, issues of justice are actually tightly connected to our ability to deliver successful solutions in our areas of crisis.
Yeah, then let's turn to what justice is exactly in your view, because under most circumstances, we would say, well, justice at its heart means that no one is oppressed, that everyone has equal basic rights and liberties, and if there are social and economic inequalities, that they also benefit the less advantaged members of a society. This is to say, our notion of justice is very much inspired by the philosopher John Rawls. But you now say his conception of justice has an important blind spot. What is that kind of blind spot?
That's right. So his conception of justice, ultimately, he starts with an argument that well-being does depend both on negative liberties and on positive liberties. Negative liberties are freedoms from governmental interference, so freedoms of association and expression and thought. Positive liberties are freedoms to participate, to be a co-contributor to public decision-making through elections, through running for office, through forms of deliberative democracy. His initial aspiration is to keep these two categories of liberty together. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, he does open up space for sacrificing positive liberties. He focuses more on the negative liberties. And people who have interpreted Rawls in his wake, so this is not really his own doing, have tended to prioritize material justice, economic justice, including in ways that erode or undermine positive liberties. So my argument, in fact, is that the strongest structure for justice is one that maintains healthy protections for positive liberties, really does connect people to participation through institutions, builds strong and effective systems of representation, permits mediation of political opinion, and synthesis and bridging across lines of difference. And if you have institutions and a culture that empowers and connects people in that way, you will, in my argument, deliver better outcomes with regard to material security, health security, all of the economic foundations of well-being.
So you say public autonomy is as important as private autonomy. Public autonomy, in your eyes, is one of the most important requirements for every human being to realize happiness and a good life. And this is a very interesting but very strong assumption, given that not everybody is interested in politics and a political lifestyle. So what leads you to this claim?
Sure. Thank you. Now, that's a really important question. So, yes, I do think autonomy is necessary for human well-being, and we have to recognize that autonomy has two lanes or two modes of expression: private autonomy, the choices we make about our intimates, about our cultural connections and commitments. But then there's also a public lane. If we live in a world where the decisions that shape our larger scale communities, our cities, our nations, are completely disconnected from our own decision-making, we will feel that as a harm or injury to our own autonomy. And we will be right. So the full expression of human autonomy does require that participation in broad collective decision-making. While I say that that is a requirement, your point is correct that there are people who will not want to make use of opportunities for that participation. As I see it, they're actually making a choice about their own public autonomy. They are choosing to exercise their public autonomy by ceding their powers to other people. And while I think that that is a choice that ultimately leaves them vulnerable, it leaves them vulnerable to the choices of others, that itself is still an exercise of public autonomy. So to make that very concrete, in Australia, for example, there is a requirement for mandatory voting, universal voting. But that doesn't actually mean that you have to vote for any particular person. People very often spoil their ballots or leave their ballot blank. And in so doing, they're saying, my action with regard to my public autonomy is to say, I'm not going to participate. That's the choice I'm making. So there will be people who make that choice. And what I am wanting to make visible is that that is a choice for how to exercise public autonomy. It's not actually the absence of it, it's a choice for how to exercise it. And that's the situation that we need, one where that lane of public autonomy is fully available to everybody, such that those who are not participating self-consciously understand and have chosen non-participation as their way of expressing their public autonomy.
So you've already said a just society must be based on political equality. Every member should have the same chance to influence the rules and the norms that regulate our society. But for now, this is a bit abstract, because we do know that people participate in very different ways. As you've already said, some individuals and groups have or will develop much more means to shape society than others. So what should a democracy do in order to guarantee political equality in a more egalitarian way?
I think one of the greatest challenges for any constitutional democracy is that it seeks to deliver, in effect, power sharing across the population. Yet, by definition, power is a good that individuals seek to acquire disproportionate shares of. So every society has a dynamic where some people or groups pursue opportunity hoarding, pursue power hoarding. Mm-hmm. So the question is really, can you in an ongoing way have frames of analysis that help make it visible when people are accruing power in that fashion, and where then the society as a whole has tools to counteract that? So I think, for instance, the debates that we're currently having around the tech giants are a great example of that. There's been a significant accrual of power by firms like Facebook, of course. And I think that, you know, coming to grips with that and building a new anti-competition policy is really important to redistributing power and identifying places where there's been a kind of power hoarding that makes power sharing challenging for the broad range of citizens. And then, yes, we need anti-monopoly policy, we need sort of better policies that undo anti-competition situations.
And you have designed a principle that is supposed to work as a control mechanism for checking whether our laws, our institutions, our procedures work well or have to be revised. And this principle is called difference without domination. Could you give us an example of how this principle could make a difference in reality?
Exactly. Thank you. Yes. So the point of the principle difference without domination is that not all social differences, not all hierarchies are problematic. In fact, freedom often generates social difference patterns of group association or organizational structures that use hierarchy to deliver public goods. So what we have to be able to do is routinely analyze our social and institutional landscape for patterns where differences or disparities have occurred, and then to consider, are those sources of domination or not? So for example, if you want to use the United States context, let's just think about incarceration for a moment. There are two really marked disparities, two significant disparities in our penal system. There is a serious overrepresentation of African-American and Latino-Latina American individuals in the US prison system relative to white Americans. There's also a disparity in the representation of male individuals relative to female in our system of incarceration. If you look at those two disparities, the former clearly arises from patterns of domination in our society generally, from how policing operates, from how educational opportunities are distributed, from how economic opportunities are distributed. So one can see points of intervention that are necessary to reduce that disparity or get rid of that disparity. With regard to the disparity between men and women in prison, however, if you analyze that, that doesn't rest on the same kinds of structures or patterns of domination. And so that's a disparity that doesn't need to trigger the same sort of response as the first disparity. So the point is that one wants to be able to take that mode of analysis and apply it across the range of social phenomena.
May I raise a question that is not very central to your book, but nevertheless important in our days? Because one of the greatest challenges today is finding a solution for the climate crisis, right? So do you have an idea of how this principle of difference without domination could work as an instrument for finding a compromise today between our legitimate interest in a good life and the equally legitimate interests of our descendants?
Thank you. That is a great question also. So I think we've all been struggling with how to approach climate change for an exceptionally long time. So in that regard, the question is, why are our policy conversations, our scientific conversations, not gaining traction with governance? And I think the answer there is actually because of the gap between technocratic understanding and popular understanding or decision-making. So paradoxically, I think the relevant kind of difference without domination that we need in the space of climate change has to do with the relationship between scientific expertise and the ordinary judgments of ordinary people. I think it's a feature of scientific expertise at the moment that scientists can often begin a conversation with a view that what they propose should simply move forward as the thing we should all do. And I think that's a misunderstanding of the place of scientific expertise in decision-making. We need scientific expertise. We should respect scientific expertise, but it needs to be connected to structures of evaluation that permit the broad range of the public to hash out values questions, key objectives. How do we think about our responsibilities to future generations versus to our current generation? And the fact is that scientists can't answer that question. We, the people, actually have to answer that question. So to do that, we need structures of deliberation that permit people to hash out those values questions while being advised by scientific experts. And I do think that there have been experiments with structures, commission structures, that give more voice to people, for example, in low-lying coastal communities, people who are in parts of the world that are already more affected by climate change, being able to connect them to people who are in places that are not as affected as of yet, for deliberative consideration looks to me like a powerful way of unlocking the conversation.
This is very interesting. So this principle of difference without domination aims to foster a connected society, as you said, and you have a highly connected society in mind in which people build bridges, bridges between different groups and their knowledge, their competences and perspectives. The more bridges there are, the easier knowledge can circulate so that everyone has access to it. But doesn't this picture maybe underestimate that there are powerful networks that want to be exclusive, that don't want to share their insights and gains with others? And doesn't it maybe underestimate as well that one needs to have the means, like financial, social, symbolic capital, in order to take advantage of this circulating knowledge?
Yes. Without any question, there will be people who are seeking exclusive control, hoarding of opportunities, accumulation of power. And so that does require a certain willingness to engage in a sort of adversarial conflict with people who are doing that. However, I think it's also important to recognize that moving towards a connected society is partly about laws, it's partly about regulations. There's sort of, in some sense, you could think of those as adversarial tools responding to those efforts for control. But there's also cultural work to be done. And I think that's a really important thing to say, that social norms, ethics have a role to play here. And in the corporate world, for example, I'm really impressed by efforts of thinkers like Colin Mayer in the UK or Rebecca Henderson here at Harvard, who are really trying to work with top corporate leaders, and it's a small club at the end of the day, to transform their own understanding of what a corporation is about. Is a corporation just about shareholders, or is a corporation about stakeholders, all of the communities who are affected by the actions of the corporation? Is there a rate of profit at which point a corporation should understand itself to be exploitative, if it's not accepting a lower level of profit and taking gains from productivity and distributing those to workers and labor? And those are changes, actually, that can flow from a shift in social norms. And I do think it's important that scholars and the general public work, in fact, to shape the norms and the ethical frameworks within which corporate leaders understand themselves to work.
This is Deutschlandfunk Kultur, and our guest is the philosopher and Harvard professor Danielle Allen. She proposes a theory of justice that strongly emphasizes political equality. For a society to be just, the most important thing, she argues, is that the way our society is organized empowers every member to participate in actively shaping society. This is why, Danielle Allen, you stress the input side of our political system more than the output side of it. But for now, the output side often undermines the input side. For instance, if you have a very, very poorly paid freelance job or even two, and you're just about making a living, it's very probable that you won't have time or interest in establishing a union or in actively engaging in a party or in a social movement. So how do you want to overcome this contradiction between input and output?
That is an excellent question. And I think you've put your finger on the hardest problem, which is that we are sort of trapped in a vicious circle where we have institutions that are less empowering and less responsive than we need. We have a civil society that leaves people feeling disconnected and alienated. And we often have a civic and political culture of resentment and frustration. And that's a dynamic that's reinforcing. So the goal is to flip from that negative equilibrium to a positive equilibrium where our political institutions are empowering and responsive and providing equal representation, where our civil society organizations are supporting connections and bridging across lines of difference, and where our civic culture is sustaining a norm and expectation of solidarity. So the question you're really asking is, how do we flip from that negative equilibrium, that vicious circle, to the positive equilibrium? And I think the answer to that is that one has to build a big field of actors in each of those three pillars: institutions, civil society, culture. And where people have the capacity They have to be the first movers, but they have to work together across that whole field in order to flip the equilibrium and make opportunities for people currently excluded from opportunities. So in other words, what I'm suggesting is there is a heavier responsibility that falls on the shoulder of people who already do have more access to time. Mm-hmm. And it's time for them to think about their own solidaristic responsibilities to people who don't have access to time to start to flip that equilibrium.
In your book, you write that your approach suggests a context-specific revision of policies, for instance, regarding the access to education, to mobility, to housing, but not a profound remodeling of how distribution and redistribution is organized. Why are you so optimistic that small reforms can make a difference here?
So I do think that micro reforms applied across the entirety of society aggregate to macro reforms. Mm-hmm. So it's not that I don't think we need large macro reforms. It's just that I think the way to get them is by redesign of mechanisms at a micro and meso level. And I think that actually right now there's much more potential for macro transformation from that route than by a sort of direct effort sort of top down to imagine a kind of comprehensive new blueprint.
Yeah. So far, we've only talked about nation states, right? But we know very well that our world is like globally interconnected. So the big question is, how can we enforce political equality in our Western democracies without betraying it elsewhere? And this is where your concept of polypolitanism comes into play. With this idea, you wish to support immigration from the global south into the global north and simultaneously reduce the chances that the host societies will refuse to accept this immigration. Can you explain a bit how polypolitanism is supposed to be helpful here?
Thanks a lot. I do think this is the hardest part of the question, how we think about the relationship between political equality in Western democracies and in the rest of the globe. And that's closely connected to the issue of immigration. And of course, immigration is also closely connected to the question of the structure of labor. Mm-hmm. So polypolitanism is a coinage in the same way that cosmopolitanism is a coinage. So cosmopolitanism was about being a member of the entire globe, the cosmos. Polypolitanism is about being a member, a political citizen, a polites in the Greek, of many communities. So poly, of course, is just Greek for many. Yeah. So the point is that we can exercise our political being, our political nature at many different levels. We can do that in our cities, in our federal states, in our nation, in transnational communities of various kinds. And the question of empowerment is really about whether people have access to empowerment along a number of different possible pathways. So when we think about immigration, at the moment, we tend to think about whether people have access to empowerment in their home country, the sending country, or at a national level in the receiving country. And one of the suggestions of polypolitanism is that it might be possible to have a multi-tiered approach to empowerment. So immigrants newly arrived in the United States, for example, might have access to empowerment through civic associations that are committed to sponsoring and giving voice to them. For me, in the United States context, this also should be connected to a pathway to citizenship, to full citizenship. But the point is that if you don't actually connect immigration to empowerment in some fashion, you are setting up a world where without free labor, basically, where there's a huge contingency of labor that is disconnected from pathways to political empowerment. And my view is that a world without free labor, that where there's not kind of bright line threshold that all labor should be free labor, is a world that routinely repeats domination, exploitation, oppression, and also erodes actually our economic well-being, our collective material well-being.
Yeah.
So the goal is to establish a kind of threshold for free labor for the globe.
Yeah, but is it enough to give immigrants a voice within civic organizations, NGOs, other work-centered institutions, etc.? Or do we need more substantial forms of participation in order to guarantee political equality for immigrants as well? Because don't we run the risk that immigrants then would only have a very partial say in how their lives look like in the country they work and live in?
So, again, I mean, so yes, in short, the answer to your question is yes. It is important that, for example, U.S. immigration policy be connected to a pathway to citizenship for migrants. The question is really what else lies along that pathway to citizenship. And that's where the suggestion is. You can have a stepping stone process to that pathway to citizenship. In fact, in the US, for instance, there are cities where immigrants who can't vote at the national level can vote. They can, in fact, participate at the municipal level. So that would be an example of a sort of stepping stone structure. And I think that that is a structure that, especially if you connect that to civil society organizations having responsibility for the integration of immigrants into the political community in a sort of phased-in way, then you have a way of achieving a sort of process of social integration, social acceptance, at the same time that you are building in avenues of participation.
Let's have a look at a different but not less important topic on education. If you want to raise your voice, you need to know how and where to speak out. You need to know how companies, how the city you live in, how politics on different levels work. And not only that, it's very helpful to have some knowledge about social ideas, about concepts and history. But this kind of democratic education is not very much promoted in our educational systems. This is a problem, you say. So what should we do about it?
Well, I do think we need public investment in rebuilding the humanistic and social sciences elements of our education. At least in the US, it's been the case that for the last few decades, the priority for public investment has been on STEM education and technology. And the evidence is that education, as we conduct it, at least currently, reduces the likelihood of young people growing into participants. They're less likely to vote, less likely to communicate with office holders, less likely to run for office. So we need to rebalance our educational system and recognize that the development of agency, the skills and tools of participation and healthy, productive participation, and the knowledge of how political institutions work to connect public opinion to governance, all of those things are critical for sustaining the life of a constitutional democracy over time. So public investment, time in school on these subjects, also rebuilding a teaching core that has mastery of these subject areas. At least in the US, we have not invested in teachers learning, for example, the discipline of political science that has fallen off the radar screen for the last three decades.
As a last point, Danielle Allen, the whole world waits with bated breath for the US elections in November. What do you hope for? And do you think your political theory has the chance of being adopted by practical politics in near future?
I certainly hope for a change of course for our country. And I we'll see. We think we all learned not to make predictions 4 years ago. And I am working consistently with policymakers, specifically in the domains of health and criminal justice and education, to try to help them build new frameworks. So I have found people quite receptive to the idea that we should be rebuilding pathways for empowerment and participation at all levels of our society. So I do hope to be able to advance that work in concrete, practical ways.
Great. Thank you so much, Danielle Allen, for this very inspiring conversation. I wish you all the very best.
Thank you. Thank you for your fantastic questions. I truly appreciate it.